Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Curzon Film Podcast. In this episode, we're talking about the charming, intimate romance, Hobbs and Shaw. And we talk to Ritesh Bhatia, the director of The Lunchbox, about his new film, Photograph. I'm Jake Cunningham, and in the film lab this week, developing thoughts on two new cinematic offerings is the perfectly composed Kelly Powell.
Hello.
And the overexposed Sam Howlett.
That's good.
Yeah, thanks. All right. So two new films to talk about. Very odd pairing, but who are we to question that, eh? People should watch what they like. to start, I think in the words of Chad Kroeger and Nickelback, should we look at this photograph?
Oh, I thought you were going to do that. I was hoping you wouldn't.
Sam, could you tell us a little bit about the story that this picture-taking tale is capturing?
Oh, I certainly can. So this is the latest from writer-director Ritesh Bhatia, who most people will know as the director of The Lunchbox, which came out in 2014 and was one of the biggest foreign language films of that year to sort of break out into the mainstream. And that was a rom-com set in Mumbai. And the photograph is also a rom-com set in Mumbai. This has a character called Rafi, who is a street photographer in Mumbai. And he takes the photo of a wealthy student, Maloney. And they're both from families, one rich, one poor, but they're both kind of under pressure to marry and find someone. Rafi in particular is under pressure from his grandmother, who is even threatening to stop taking her medication until he finds a wife. He sends her the photo of Maloney to say, look, this is my fiance, please leave me alone, I've found someone. And unexpectedly, his grandma comes to Mumbai to meet her grandson's fiance. And so he then has to track down Maloney and convince her to pretend to be his fiance. And you might expect maybe some sparks to fly.
Whoa.
This little ruse.
Yeah, and we actually got to speak to Ritesh about the film.
We did.
It was Ed, who listeners would have heard on our last week's episode, mm-hmm. on our roundup of the best films of the year so far, who was meant to be here today. R.I.P. Ed.
Who did not die.
Anyway.
But he died in our hearts.
He did die in our hearts, yeah.
Yeah.
There's an empty chair at the end of the recording.
There genuinely is.
What did you think of the film, Ed?
Oh, God. You can hear the tears. So Ed spoke to Ritesh about the film, so we'll hear from him in just a moment. But let's just quickly get up to speed on Ritesh Bhatia. So he made this film, The Lunchbox. Before that, he had made short films, and those got him into a Sundance Lab program. And that's where all that kind of sprung from. But The Lunchbox becomes this mega hit, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and I think Indian cinema, it's funny, especially in the UK box office, there's more often than not, there is a Indian film in there. But it's just sort of for that core Indian audience or for that Bollywood audience. And it never really breaks into the mainstream. But The Lunchbox really did in a massive way. Yep. I remember like my housemates at uni going to see it. Housemates who weren't particularly into film. But I remember them going to see The Lunchbox.
Yeah,
it was that much of a big thing.
Yeah. And then in 2017, he makes two films. You got The Sense of an Ending, which was the Julian Barnes adaptation, which is an interesting film to be your second feature, because it's not a, like, you may, on the surface, that feels like maybe like a ITV Sunday night, like Silver Pound adaptation. But it's quite a curiosity, that one. It's quite an odd film.
Yeah.
We did a podcast on it
couple
of years ago, yeah. And then also Our Souls at Night. Which is
what?
Our Souls at Night?
Say it much slower, please.
Our Souls at Night.
Yes, that's it. Thank
you. Yeah. With Robert Redford, which was also in 2017 as well.
Which, unfortunately, is only famous for that title.
Yeah. I can't say I've seen it, but apparently the performances are excellent.
I've heard the title many times.
And so then makes these two, like, pretty well-regarded Western films.
Yeah.
And now goes back to India and makes this new one, Photograph. So here is Ritesh Bhatra on his latest.
I'm delighted to welcome Ritesh Bhatra to the Curzon Film Podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
We're obviously talking about your new film, Photograph, which just had its UK premiere at the Edinburgh Film Festival. I'm going to start by asking you how you are finding audience reactions to the film as you're taking it to different territories around the world. So obviously, it premiered in Sundance and it's gone to it's come to the UK now. I mean, how are you finding people's general reactions, the audience reaction?
No, the audience has been very kind. We premiered in Sundance. I saw it over there. And then we went to Berlin. And then the movie released in India and in the US. And it's been really warm. And Edinburgh was very nice. It was a very nice Q&A. And you know, these kinds of things are very interesting because, you know, people have other things to do at a festival. And when they all stay back for a Q&A, I think it's a good sign. I really enjoyed it. I'm loving being back in London. I haven't been here in a while. So I'm really looking forward to the release.
I mean, it's something of a return to your roots in a way, in that you were sort of returning to your native Mumbai after sort of your previous few films where you've made in the US. I mean, what inspired this decision after these recent English Angus films to go back to your native India and create this new romantic story?
Well, you know, I have been really eager to get back to my own writing and to direct my own writing, and that's something that I really enjoy. And so for me, it was more of that, you know, it's just something that I had written, and I was very eager to direct something that I have written. So just went back and made it happen. You know, I didn't. So much of making movies is about putting them together, and really getting behind something and making it happen. And for me, it was really fun also to have a nice reunion with the whole crew. And everybody came back. You know, from everybody I worked with on the Lunchbox, a costume designer, production designer, line producer, everybody came back to work on it. So it was a very nice reunion, but I was very excited mostly to just direct my own writing again, because it's something I really enjoy, and that's something that I want to keep doing. So I spend a lot of my time now writing, generating material for myself to direct, because it's something I really enjoy. You know, I think you feel something innately, you're so aware of that first impulse or the center of the movie when you're directing your own writing. You're connected to it in a way that's hard to be if you haven't written it. So I really enjoy that. I enjoy that process of directing something that I wrote myself.
Where did the inspiration for the story come from?
Well, you know, it came back when I was growing up in India, and even now, I think there's a lot of movies made about you know, the poor guy, rich girl, and most of them, you know, are riffs on Taming of the Shrew. Because a girl, because she's rich, somehow she has to be a shrew. I thought that, well, what if there was a way to make a movie about a poor guy and a rich girl spending time together? Because that would never happen. It's kind of a fantasy. They would have a pretty, you know, sort of short transaction about, you know, how much is this and here's the change. So I thought, what if there was a way to sustain a movie of two people spending time together and what they could, you know, if they could help each other find corners of their heart that didn't know existed. So it kind of started from there, and then I wrote that. The first scene I wrote was the scene that is now the last scene in the movie. I always find about my writing that, and that the first thing I write is generally what the movie's about. And then I go about trying to figure out, you know, who the characters are and then work backwards and forwards from there. But yeah, that last scene of the movie is the first thing I wrote, and that really sort of drove me to write the rest of it.
And you're working with these big big actors, big Bollywood actors. I mean, how did they get involved in the film?
Well, Nawaz is somebody I've worked with before. I worked with him on Lunchbox. And Sanya came in through the process of auditions. And meanwhile, she had another movie that she was working on that ended up being a huge Bollywood success story, and that was great for our movie. But you know, the thing about these actors is that one, they're great actors, but they also do work in the sort of the mainstream Bollywood song and dance movies, and then they bring their audiences along with them into, you know, a movie that's more art house and more intimate, which is great, I think, which is great, you know, and it's good for them because they get a chance to do something different. And it's great for, you know, filmmakers because they get new audiences into their movies. So, you know, I loved working with them. I think they both are great actors, and I think they both are, they're going to go on to do a lot of work even outside India. So, you know, it's great. I'm happy to see that the movie's traveling a lot and releasing in, you know, sort of mainstream cinemas around the world, outside of sort of the Indian and diaspora audiences, that, you know, because there's a whole sort of world of Indian films that only Indian people watch, which is also great. But you know, I think it's nice that our stories travel too, and other people watch them.
Mm. The two central performances are very powerful, but very very gentle and very subtle in a way. But juxtaposed with this very larger than life character of the grandmother, is she inspired by anyone, any grandmother that, or your own grandmother, that anyone that you knew?
Yeah, you know, I invariably end up having this kind of a character in my movie. Even in Lunchbox, there was a character that you don't see called the auntie who's upstairs. And she was pretty overwhelming in her own way. And so is this grandma. And I've been fortunate to have, like, these sort of mother figures in my life who are really sort of the dominating force in a story. So no, absolutely, you know, my own mom and even my grandma, when she was alive, you know, they're pretty demanding, always demanding answers. So you know, I'm happy to steal from life. And also the actor, Farooq Jaffer, she's a real force of nature. She was India's first female radio presenter back in the 50s. So she, you know, she doesn't take no for an answer, and you know, she also brought herself to the part. And you know, I was very happy. She's one of those actors who's always been played the grandma, even when she was young. So it was really fun to work with her.
I think one of the strongest elements of the film is that it's so fundamentally nice and gentle. It's a novel way of contemporary romance films, which always invariably are quite tragic in a way. I mean, and there's something to be said for the way the film avoids cliches and sort of the cliches of the romantic genre, and just and goes along at its own pace, and it's very gentle, and it's just was this intentional for you? And was it intentional for you to just tell this very straightforward, nice story without any big narrative complications or tragic elements?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. You know, I think it's just a movie about two people spending time together and how they find corners of their heart that didn't know existed. But is that not big? I don't know. I think it's a pretty big deal. I think they go through some really fundamental changes in their lives. Like, if they hadn't met each other, they would probably be in different trajectories. But yeah, you know, I don't know. I think it's up to, now it's turned over to the people to decide, but I think it's a pretty big deal that they spend time together. It's a huge deal.
No, totally. I mean, if it was, say, to have a US remake, then I'm sure it would be completely changed and chopped around, and there'll be a narrative a crux around it that just changes the whole thing. In a way, it's also a spiritual sequel to The Lunchbox, in a way, in that it's about the power of kindness, in a way. I mean, Is this inspired by the films that you like to watch? Or is there any films that inspire you or filmmakers that inspire you?
Well, absolutely. A lot of filmmakers inspire me. You know, Louis Malle inspires me a lot. His movies are always about, you know, the scripts are really strong and the writing plays a huge role. And you know, he's a very humble director, you know, that he's telling the story of these characters and not imposing himself on every frame of the movie. And I love directors who do that. You know, I love Asghar Farhadi's work. I think also a director's job is to so much to make sure that the movie doesn't feel like it's been written. That's essentially what a director does, I think. So yeah, you know, I'm always trying to find a way to do that, I guess.
What are you working on next?
Well, I'm writing a movie that's set in London, and I'm hoping to make it later this year. I'm also adapting a great Indian novel to a series, episodic. And I'm working on something for the stage. So I'm just working a lot, trying to stay busy. Mm-hmm. You know, hustling, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I really enjoy that. I enjoy being busy. I enjoy just, you know, thinking about the next thing. So I often find it hard to do sort of this part of the process where the movie's going to come out and you have to, because my mind has already moved on to the next things. But you know, I mean, it's also really nice that the movie's traveling. So I'm happy to be here.
Sure. Pritesh Bhatia, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, so it's a film called Photograph that starts with a photographer.
Mm-hmm.
And that immediately kind of makes me think of the challenges of making films about photography. Like we see films about filmmaking, I'm almost immediately on edge, and the same thing with photography as well. It brings back stuff like Finding Vivian Mayer and Life, the Anton Corbin film about Robert Stock and James Dean, which are films that I know were regarded by some, but felt like often with these films about photography or particularly other photographers, you've got people, directors, almost trying to make their stamp on someone else's way of capturing an image. And so when I saw the name of this film straight away, I thought, what is its relationship going to be to photography? And how is he as a filmmaker going to approach that? But pretty early on, I realized I didn't have to worry about that at all.
Yeah.
It's pretty lo-fi, charming, almost like a mixture between like Bollywood, mumblecore, and Richard Curtis.
Yeah, that's a really good way to describe it. Because like the film has this meet cute at the beginning, and it's like the ultimate meet cute. Like, street photographer takes a picture of a young girl, and that sort of chance coincidence encounter shapes both of their lives, and the film is full of these kind of chance encounters. And I think if that sounds conventional, then the rest of the film is done in a, I don't know, not quite as conventional way as you might expect this kind of film to play out.
Yeah, like there is some of this where it's like quite quiet, and it's
understated.
Yeah, it really is. And it actually will leave key plot elements that would be traditional for a romantic comedy just by the wayside, or just assume that we know that those events happened, just so he can just spend more time quietly with the characters having conversations.
Yeah.
Which I know at some points you might think this could actually do with someone kind of more explaining what has happened.
Do they show how he finds her?
Kind of. I mean, it's a little bit inexplicable that this his taxis keep showing up where she is.
Yeah, like that. There is the first 30 minutes or so, like, because it needs to kind of quickly establish the dynamic. We talked about something similar with Only You as well. And the mathematics and logistics of figuring out how that we can get them to meet, split them apart, and get them back together again. I have to say, it did kind of lose me here. But then you just, whatever, go with it.
Yeah.
They're back together, and then they're just having these conversations. Maybe a little bit before sunset at times as well.
Yeah.
But in Mumbai.
Definitely some of it. Mm. I think what's interesting is that both these lead characters are very quiet and introverted. Like, in these films, if one character is like that, the kind of the thought is that the other character has to be so big to kind of counteract that. But these characters are both very quiet, both say very little. Their facial expressions are, you know, very
muted.
Stoic. Yeah, very muted. But that really works for the rest, for the whole film, I think.
Yeah, and it feels like a different India that we're seeing here. Well, I'm sure for people in India this is like more common, but as a Western audience, because we, as you mentioned, Sam, we get so few of these films that come over, this feels very different to what we are used to seeing. It's not like the chaotic slum poverty streets that we might see in Slumdog Millionaire or Lion, and nor is it like the super high-end saturated Bollywood glamour. And I really liked that. Like, when we're suddenly just given space, stillness, which is core to the film, to those characters as well, as a reflection of who they are. I actually really liked that about it. Like, and that felt like something that I haven't seen before.
Yeah, Mumbai is often this kind of depicted as this like complete area of chaos and carnage, where it's like millions of people in one, squashed into one small area, and there's like these packed trains and taxis and street markets. And yeah, like you say, and we're used to seeing, like, especially in things like Slumdog Millionaire and Lion, this kind of like really harsh, poverty-stricken areas.
It's like a very definite aesthetic that comes with those sort of films.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You do get these great flashes of colour, like when they go inside
into the taxis, yeah.
Like, I want whoever's designing taxis in Mumbai to come over to London, because like it's like neon blue zebra print. It's amazing. And I really like that. I do have some reservations on it. Within that first 30 minutes that I mentioned, there is a hint of that creepy stalker rom-com trope.
Yep.
Like, I've got this photo, I've got to track it down. And
yep.
I can't say I'm a big, big fan of that. But those little moments, like particularly bits of to do with food, I really enjoyed. Like it's really delves into the like familial relationships that people will have with food, like passed down from their grandmother or father or whatever. And I love people talking about that.
Mm.
I think the core of this is a couple of lines like, everyone's running these days, and no one gets peace in Mumbai, not even in death. Which are a few lines that I wrote down, because that, to me, that's this film. I can't say I'm like super invested in the romance as such, but I am more interested in the characters and the kind of spaces that they've crafted for themselves and just hanging out with them. Plus, it's got a really great ending. Like,
it does have a good ending. Yeah.
Really surprisingly subversive and bold ending for a film of this nature.
Yeah. Also, not to make this film sound too twee, it's nice to see nice things happen to nice people.
Yeah.
Sometimes in film.
Yeah. We've mentioned a few films here already, like, obviously the Lunchbox.
Yeah. If you like the Lunchbox, and a lot of people do, I definitely think this is one for you.
Yeah. But other stuff there as well, like maybe the Before films.
Yeah.
About Time, even. Like, there's so many things that you could lift stuff from.
Definitely Richard Curtis-y at times, yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. So now for the second part in our double bill, which I'm assuming we are the first people to ever do this double bill, and maybe the only people to ever do it. It's time to move from Ritesh Bhatia's Photograph to Fast and Furious, Hobbs and Shaw. All right. So
where do we start?
Yeah.
Where do we start?
Right. We've got eight films for people to catch up on. So go do your homework and then come back to us. No, I think for the maybe even the studio setting this up as a new entry point, these are characters. Like, this is the Hobbs and Shaw franchise to get in on.
It's a spin-off, but I don't think you have to see the other ones to Because
no, I haven't.
You haven't.
No,
well, we all haven't seen all of them.
No,
I've seen one of them. I've seen weirdly Fast and Furious 6.
That's an odd one to start with. No, I saw the first three.
Okay.
Like as they came out chronologically in real life, and then I didn't watch any of the others. So these are totally new characters.
Did you know that three is now actually seven?
Yes, that's what I mean. Yeah, like, I watched the first three that came out.
They retcon the hell out of all of these films all the time.
Yeah, I do like that.
Even in Hobbs and Shaw, there's just a throwaway line that completely changes something that happened in a previous film.
Oh, you'll have to tell me what that is after this. But to get you up to speed, listener, but I'm sure you're incredibly well-versed already, Dwayne Johnson and Jason Statham craft their very own off-ramp from the Fast and Furious franchise for this standalone tale featuring Luke Hobbs, that's Dwayne Johnson, former FBI agent who's just got...
DSS. Yeah.
DSS agent. Still DSS?
No, he retires.
He's now retired, yeah.
He's good.
They just call him a lawman. He's a lawman.
He's a lawman and... He is, in previous entries, teamed up with the family.
Well, initially he was hunting the family.
Yeah.
Then he teamed up with them.
Because there's a lot of respect about them.
A lot of respect in these films, the family.
And Jason Statham, who is Deckard Shaw, is the villain in number seven.
Yes, he's a rogue British special agent in seven, who's getting revenge on the family for putting his brother in a coma in the sixth one. And then he is in prison with Luke Hobbs in the eighth one, who's been framed and set up. And they meet in prison, and then they help each other break out of prison and stop the real bad guy, who is Charlize Theron, who plays Cypher, who is a hacker, who has been behind the events of six and seven the whole time. And she blackmails Dom Toretto into helping her because he has a son he didn't know about, with a woman who wasn't Letty, who's played by Michelle Rodriguez, who they thought was dead, but is actually alive, as you found at the end of the fifth one, and she has amnesia, and she's helping Alan Shaw in the fifth one.
Yes, that's a good one, because when I watched six, and it was like, she's alive. I don't know who this is. All right, so there we are. So now we all are all up to speed, and Idris Elba's here. He is, as quoted from the film, Black Superman.
I'm Black Superman.
He has been genetically modified. He's like half robot, half human.
Mechanically modified.
Yep. And so this is Fast and Furious fully accepting that they are like related to reality. We are basically like a superhero franchise as well. I know this week one of the writers said that they have not ruled out going to space. And
that would be fine.
Yep. So I gather, like, between the two of you, you're pro Fast and Furious.
I'm pretty pro Fast and Furious. I don't love that. People love these films, and the seventh one definitely is in the top 10 highest grossing films of all time. I think especially so the first three that Kelly has seen are very grounded in reality, more or less.
They are like street racing.
They're street racing. Yeah. They're kind of like Point Break, where like an undercover cop enters this sort of world of extreme sports to expose criminals. And they were all about the street racing and the car chases, but they're relatively grounded. But from the fifth one, which introduced Luke Hobbs, the stunts have gotten bigger, the actions got bigger as well, so has the box office. So the budgets keep getting higher and higher and higher, and the expectations get higher. So now they all have these completely insane, over-the-top car stunts.
Yep. Yeah.
Not only car, just any kind of insane action sequence.
They're like Mission Impossible with added like mental stuff.
Mission Impossible sells itself on the reality of the stunts.
Exactly.
This sells itself on the unreality of the
spectacle. Yeah.
And that totally has its place.
Yeah.
And I think this film is very entertaining. Do see it on as big a screen as possible and as loud as possible. For that reason, it's really fun because there is genuinely spectacle here that you're not going to get anywhere else.
No.
And I admire it for that. I do think it tries to make itself a different type of film than maybe the other Fast and Furious films, which I at their core, as much as they are ridiculous, there's a sincerity to them. Like they know what they're doing, but they do take themselves
very seriously,
and this film does not.
Mm.
No.
It kind of did. Well, it is directed by the same guy who did Deadpool
2.
Yeah. And Ryan Reynolds has a cameo in it. And you do kind of feel like they're going for that kind of humor.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really work in this film for me. Well, it's at its best when it's doing what it wants to do. And yeah. That's the stunts.
Absolutely, yeah. The film kind of flatlines for me when people just start talking to each other and thinking that their conversations are funny. Statham and Dwayne Johnson in other films are great as being like on the side for like people to bounce off of.
Mm.
But they can't, when they're both so bouncy, like they just kind of go nowhere. Like they need, like, I think Vanessa Kirby is maybe meant to be the straight man for them.
I think she's really good in this.
Yeah.
And she was great in the last Mission Impossible film.
Yeah.
And I think she does that really well, actually. She's the straight man. Mm. I think she does a really good job of it. The straight woman.
And so when she's not there, you kind of actually feel her absence. Which considering how much like of a caricature the other two men are and how much screen presence they take, real credit to her for just coming in and like owning her role in this franchise.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. I noticed on the credits at the start that it's a $7 production, which is Dwayne Johnson's production company. So he's clearly like trying to, like, after coming in at the fifth entry of this franchise and now taking a stranglehold on it, and, like, pulling it off in his own direction. And because of this film, the characters aren't going to be in the ninth traditional Fast and Furious franchise as well. Nothing to do with his hatred for Vin Diesel at all.
This town's too big for this town's too small for another enormous bald grizzly voiced actor.
Absolutely. So Kelly, you mentioned David Leitch already, the director of Deadpool 2. He was he was an uncredited director on John Wick.
Yep. Him and David Leitch and
Chad
Stahelski were stuntmen that got into directing with John Wick, and then Chad Stahelski stuck with the John Wick franchise, but David Leitch went off to do Atomic Blonde, which I think the plot's all over the place, but the action's really impressive in that film, similar to here. And then he did Deadpool 2, and now he's here with this, and he's got a real sort of, you know, a kinetic energy for these kind of action films.
And, like, he's not gone from, like, people might have seen John Wick and he could have done, like, a Colin Trevorrow and be like, right, here are the keys to an enormous franchise.
Yeah.
But it's, like, he has actually made steps up the ladder there in terms of budget. And
he's also a veteran of, like, Hollywood films in terms of stunts. They both worked on The Matrix and everything.
Yeah. Like, this film's finale ends in Samoa, which, like, the final 20 minutes of this, like, that's, for me, where the best spectacle of the whole thing is. And actually really fun to take the franchise away from the urban sprawl and industry that it has been in. And it genuinely feels like a new direction that it could have gone down. And that's really exciting, those final bits.
So, Kelly, you've seen like the Fast and Furious films from when they were grounded and took themselves more seriously than they do compared to this one.
Mm.
What's it like thinking of what the Fast and Furious films used to be compared to where they've come now?
Funnily enough, I got the same feeling that I had when watching the first ones, where you kind of like, you know, when the music drops and they're like doing these stunts to the music and you're kind of like, oh, this is Hollywood at its best. You know, you're like, you get that, like, that excitement. You're just like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
This is just cool. And so I had that same feeling in this one, but totally different films.
Yeah.
But still, it's just, you know, I said earlier that I read, I think it was The Guardian that called it a fervently brainless delight. And I think that is what this film is. It's dumb fun.
Yeah.
It's, you don't have to think too hard. You switch off. And that's what a lot of people go to the movies for, just to sort of be transported somewhere else and just enjoy what they're seeing. So I liked it.
It does that fun, dumb fun really well, I think. Yeah. And that's what this franchise is really good at for me.
Yeah. Definitely one for like Fast and Furious fans and John Wick fans as well. So do go check this one out. But if you don't fancy that, you can always check out something on Curzon Home Cinema if you just want to stay at home. We did a podcast a while back on Happy as Lazaro, which has just joined the service. And the Lunchbox is on there.
Photograph. So oh, great. You can do a double of those. If you have a Curzon membership, you can watch the Lunchbox for free as it is part of Curzon 12 this month.
Oh, great. Cool. So do make sure you do that. If you're a member at the cinema, you get that one for free. There's a few events happening, Kelly.
Yep. So at Curzon Richmond on Tuesday the 6th, so next week Tuesday, we have a special screening for the 50th anniversary of Lindsay Anderson's If. And that's the film that launched Malcolm McDowell's career. It's followed by a Q&A with actor David Wood, and he'll also be signing copies of his book Filming If, which will be available for purchase at the event. And then at Curzon Soho on Tuesday the 13th, we have a special screening of Apocalypse Now Final Cut, a never-before-seen and newly restored cut of Coppola's spectacular cinematic masterpiece.
If you want to come along to any of those, avoid disappointment by booking ahead. You do that on curzoncinemas.com/events. So if you've got any thoughts on Photograph or Hobbs & Shaw, you can let us know by tweeting at Curzon Cinemas, or you can let us know if you want as well, individually. We let people know our Letterboxd names last week. So that's where we're tracking all the films that we're watching and reviewing. Mm-hmm. So you can follow us on there. Sam, your username on Letterboxd is
Sam Howlett.
No,
is it?
Hey, this
happens every week. I don't know.
Sam _ Howlett, I think.
Is it?
There we are. S_ Howlett. And Kelly, you're on Letterboxd at
Kelly P EEE.
And I'm there. Just Jake Cunningham. All right, no issue.
I'm going to get S_ Howlett tattooed on my arm.
Yeah.
Hey, don't do that.
All right. So if it's your first time listening to the show and you want to stick around for some more, you can subscribe. We do the show every week, and that's on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, wherever you get your pods. And if you're there and you want to leave us a review, that'd be wonderful. And thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.